Heavenly Father, we want to thank you so much that we are afforded this time to come together, to learn together, to be drawn to your word, and to know that it is you who is the authority behind the truth, that these are not just our own ideas or opinions, but because you are our creator, you are our Lord, you are our master, you are the one who calls for us to follow and obey you because you know best for us. And you know how it is that we might live in such a way that would honor and glorify you. So may we consider your glory to be at stake in these matters, that we are not here to uphold just a particular lifestyle. We are not here to promote ourselves or anything to draw attention to us, but how can we take all that we have been given, knowing that we are called to be stewards? We are called to be those who would handle what you have given, that you have entrusted to us, that it doesn't belong to us. It all belongs to you. And we are given opportunity to exercise how we might use these things for the sake of your kingdom. So challenge us to consider how we might learn and grow and change in being stewards for the sake of your name. Amen. I have a question for you to start off this morning. What is money? The other night I was with my girls and there was a tune that just came to my mind, something like the money, money, money. I just remember hearing that. I couldn't remember from where, and then it dawned on me it was from Pitch Perfect, because I've watched those movies with my girls. That's the only line I remember, just money, money, money. When you consider the concept of money, I think we all understand that money somehow is equated to something valuable. And yet, if we really take some time to think about the concept of money, it's actually very interesting. Now, I picked up a book. It's called Money, The Unauthorized Biography. And I just read the first few chapters of it. It was fascinating because this idea of money, they're trying to trace historically, you know, where did it come from? And there is this conventional idea of money as a commodity of monetary exchange. In other words, you swap goods, and there's some sense where you work together with other people, and you exchange things of value, and there's something that's used to represent that exchange. So for us, the most tangible sense of that is paper money, right? Bills or coins, and historically that has been kind of the symbol of money because that's what's been lasting. But if you look on your dollar bills, at least in terms of American currency, it says, "In God we trust." Now, I don't know how many of you really take time to think about, so why did they put that there? I mean, why did they actually put "In God we trust"? When we live in a culture that obviously wants to erase any notion of God from our lives now, why do they put that phrase, "In God we trust"? Well, in the book, it talks about this island in the Pacific called Yap. Okay, and it's a small island, a few thousand people, and according to Western standards, it would be considered very primitive. But one thing that they found, even though this was a small island with only a few thousand inhabitants, it actually had a very complex society. There was a caste system, tribe of slaves. They even had clubhouses or clubs for fishing and fighting fraternities. They actually had fraternities on this island. They also had a rich dancing tradition, and they had a native religion, even with the Genesis myth. But one of the things that they found about this culture was that they had a monetary system. Now, they only had three things that they really had as their commodities. Fish, coconuts, and sea cucumbers. You know what sea cucumbers are? It's like that slimy stuff that eats all the junk off the bottom of the ocean, and then they prepare it in Chinese restaurants as a delicacy, right? And I remember looking at it one time going, what in the world is that? Well, in this culture, that was their luxury item, okay? So very interesting. Now, even though they only had that very limited market to work with, they didn't operate on a barter system. You know, a lot of people think, well, the most basic fundamental way of trying to do things in an economic sense would be a barter system. But a barter system falls short because you don't always have exactly what someone else wants, right? And to have an equal exchange, it doesn't work. So they have to find a different way to make it work. So they actually had these coins called fei. And these coins were stones that ranged, they were circular stones that ranged from a diameter of a foot to 12 feet with a hole in the middle so that poles could be inserted so that they could be transported. And this was their monetary unit, these huge stones. Now, the value of the stones depended on their size as well as the fineness of the grain, the whiteness of the limestone. But what happened was, as they would have their, you know, exchanges, these things were a pain to carry. I mean, can you imagine trying to move like a 300-pound stone, and that's like worth like $5? And if you really wanted to get something expensive, you get like a 12-foot stone, and that's like $10,000. I mean, you know, just when you think about it, who wants to do that? So what they did is they stopped moving these stones, and they just used that stone kind of as a marker to say, based on the value of that stone, we will exchange credits that have some sense of value. Okay? Now, I'm not a big econ person. You know, I don't know how that all works, but I was trying to understand this kind of thing, that these rocks were what assigned value, but they're just rocks. And you go, how many rocks did they have? Well, they actually would ship them from another island. And they said that maybe a few hundred years before, there was a large cargo of these rocks that the ship sank. So these rocks are at the bottom of the ocean. But they still had value. These people never saw these rocks, okay? But somehow they still used that as a way to say, I have so much wealth, and I can use that wealth to purchase other things. And you know, as I put this in my, you know, trying to think through this, here's this what we would call primitive people who have actually this kind of complex idea of a monetary system. And you go, huh, they were isolated for hundreds of years, and yet they were able to come up with something like that. That there's this idea of value that's transferable, but it's all just in concept. It's not about the actual physical item. In 1565, the Knights of Malta, they were besieged by the Turks. They ran out of gold and silver, so they were forced to mint coins using copper. And the motto that they stamped on these coins, it was to remind the citizens of the source of the value. This is what they stamped. Not the metal, but trust. Not the metal, but trust. So what they were saying is, it's not the copper that gives the value. It's the trust in what this represents. And I was like, huh, interesting. You are placing your trust in something for it to have some value that you can then use for whatever purposes. So then it kind of made sense. Why did those who printed American money put "In God We Trust"? Well, I'd like to think that there's some biblical principle involved here. That our trust wasn't meant to be put in money or even what stands behind the money, gold, right? Fort Knox. But actually, it's God that we would place our trust. Because when it really comes down to it, money is of such temporary value. I'm sure you followed the news this past week. There were two suicides of very well-known people. One, Kate Spade, and even I know Kate Spade. because there's purses that say Kate Spade. I didn't know who she was. I just know that it seemed to be very expensive and popular. And then Anthony Bourdain. That name I know too, because I watched a video of how much he likes In-N-Out and Korean food. I like him just because of that. But then you think, for all their accomplishment, for all their notoriety, for all their success, and even their wealth, why would they kill themselves? Why would the very people who have reached, we would say, the pinnacle of all that most people here, at least in America, are striving for, and that is financial success, to make a name for yourself, why did that not give them enough reason to live? It's so sad. And when you watch how the world responds, they're shocked, they don't understand, but what they do see is that there's something tragic about this, and it is tragic. But you know what's more tragic? Is that despite seeing what happens, people will still follow the same path that these folks followed. And they will still seek the same things that these people actually were able to accomplish. And even Christians will follow that same path, even hearing that the Word of God says that the things of this world will not pass. They will pass. And they're not going to last. Yet we still pursue that path. As Christians, we cannot afford to follow the world in this way. You know, there's something about movies that gives an image. And I think more than movies, books actually give a way to imagine things. And in the Chronicles of Narnia, there's the Voyage of the Dawn Treader. You remember that? And there's a boy named Eustace Scrub. And Eustace Scrub is one of the cousins of the Pevensey kids. And he goes along on this adventure, and King Caspian now, he is searching for the seven lost lords of Narnia. Okay, now, if you haven't read this, you need to read it. Okay, it's a wonderful collection of stories. But for those of you who know this story, what they do is they're looking for these lords, right? And they go to an island, and Eustace wanders off, even though he's told not to do this, and he happens upon a cave. And in that cave, there's treasure. There's treasure. And he knows, like, wow, this must be, you know, some collection from something. What he doesn't know is that this is a dragon's treasure. Okay. So he goes into it, and he slips on this this arm ring, and he's looking at all these jewels and all this gold and whatever, and then he falls asleep on it. And what he doesn't realize is that as he falls asleep on this dragon hoard, he turns into a dragon. And if you read the rest of the story, it tells you what happens. But I thought it was interesting. Both in the Chronicles of Narnia and in Lord of the Rings, there's something about a dragon with treasure that's used to depict this idea of one who puts such value in gold and treasures. But what does it do to them? It changes their hearts into a dragon. That's what happens to Eustace. In fact, if you watch The Lord of the Rings, and you remember Smaug, the dragon, and as Bilbo goes in to look for the Arkenstone, and the Arkenstone alone is worth everything, right? But he's, and I love the way they portrayed this. There's just mountains of gold and jewels. And you know, Bilbo is like sliding through it. And I don't know about you, this is just me. I thought, if I could only go there and just grab one back, I'd be good. But what are you asking for if that's what you're looking for as the epitome of life? Well, last week we introduced this series on stewardship. We talked about Matthew 6, 19 and 21. I want to read it again. So look there. Matthew 6, 19 and 21 says, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in or steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." And I shared this last week. Randy Alcorn's written a little book called The Treasure Principle, and pretty much the outline from today is from this book. It's a wonderful book because it gives some very clear principles that provide a biblical framework for how you should view this whole idea of money and possessions. Treasures on earth are temporary in nature, and you can't take it with you. But according to this treasure principle, and if you remember, it's you can't take it with you, but you can send it on ahead. There is a way to invest what you have on earth for heavenly purposes that will last for eternity. So that's really the question. With all that God has given you and entrusted to you, it wasn't given to you so that you could say it's mine. It was entrusted as a stewardship so that you would take it as this is God's. Now, God is entrusting me with this opportunity to use it for the sake of his kingdom. So the question you really have to first start is, do I really acknowledge that all things belong to God? Or do I hold on to things as if they're my own? Well, one way we see that is if you look at kind of the trajectory of your thought process, what are you doing with your life? What is it all for? Is it for you or is it for God? Now, we've talked about this so many times, and especially last year, if you remember our theme for last year, you remember our theme for last year? What was it? Soli Deo Glory, SDG, right? That if I could be like Johann Sebastian Bach and in my work as a composer, sign off and say SDG, everything I do to compose music is for the glory of God. That was his job. What do you do for your job? Do you sign off SDG on your job? That this job is for the glory of God. Not only that, everything that I have, whether it's my home, my car, my clothes, any material possession, do I see it as a gracious gift from God that I've been given to use for the sake of his kingdom? Or do you take all these things and store it up for yourself? Turn over to Luke chapter 12. And Jesus gives a parable. And these parables are wonderful stories to give a clear central lesson. Let's start at verse 15, Luke 12. "Then he said to them, 'Beware and be on your guard against every form of greed, for not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions.'" So that's the principle Jesus is opening up with. Beware. You need to look out for this. They had the same problem back then. And what was it? The problem of greed. That there are so many different forms of greed. And then he says something very interesting. Not even when one has abundance does his life consist of his possessions. Your life is not about possessions. And then he tells a parable, verse 16, saying, "The land of a rich man was very productive, and he began reasoning to himself, saying, 'What shall I do, since I have no place to store my crops?' Then he said, 'This is what I will do. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool! This very night your soul is required of you, and now who will own what you have prepared? So is a man who stores up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God.'" So who is the fool? The fool is the one who stores up his treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. You know, this is a tragic story, right? Someone who's worked hard. You could transfer that to today. Someone who went to school, got an advanced degree, got a great job, and is accumulating wealth. In fact, so much wealth, he has to build more things to contain that wealth. Back in those days, grain was one way to measure wealth. And so he says, well, my barns aren't big enough. I have to build bigger barns. So you can see he has these plans in motion. But the plans all center around himself. He says to his own soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. So he's looking forward to the good life. You know, and I think, isn't that kind of what a lot of people are told? Work hard, make a lot of money so that at one point you could retire. You know, as John Piper wrote in his book, Don't Waste Your Life, so that you could go to the beach and collect seashells. You know, or play in a softball league for 50 years and older. And I was thinking about that. I'm like, I don't know if I can play anymore. I can't even run right. But there's a sense where people are saying, but that's what I'm living for. I'm actually living for the retirement. I'm not even living for what I can accomplish now. It's whatever I can accomplish is to set me up for a future where I can enjoy the good life. But what we don't know is when that life's going to end. Yeah, you know, I remember sharing this story maybe some time back when Angie and I went on our honeymoon and we're at Maui and we're at one of those dinner things. It was like some Hawaiian singer guy, and he was singing these Hawaiian songs, walking around and kind of crooning these Hawaiian songs, and it was weird. And I remember he came right next to me and he was singing to me. Just really close, and I was like, that's weird. But right across the table from us was an elderly couple, and they were celebrating, I think, 50 years or something like that, their anniversary, but they were kind of old, and we had some kind of food. I don't remember what it was, but at one point in the dinner, the guy just leans over and vomits, and that kind of, kills the mood. He just vomits, and then his wife is like, I'm so sorry, and they had to leave. And I thought, how sad. Like, you work your whole life so that you can go to Hawaii, and then now this guy obviously has some health issues. He can't even enjoy a meal, and he vomits at the feast. And not only that, it kind of kills it for everybody else. And I just remember thinking, though, but that image still is very vivid in my mind, because I was thinking, like, how sad. Like, you live for that kind of a moment. You know, you... 50 years, and we're going to go celebrate, and now you can't even enjoy it. Well, in this case, in the parable, God says, you fool, your soul is required of you. Who will own what you have prepared? I don't think we like to think about that. Right? You're like, hey, John, why do you got to be so depressing? I mean, let me enjoy. I just graduated, Dr. James, right? Just graduated. He's like, I had to pay all this money to go to school. Like, why are you going to talk like this? Well, it's because there's truth to this. Now, you'll see some of the principles that Randy Alcorn puts, and I'm going to walk through them. And I want to really challenge you to think through these. First, God owns everything. I'm his money manager. We are managers of the assets that God has entrusted to us. Like I said earlier, it's not that God gave us something so that it actually belongs to us. It's just a stewardship. It's entrusted to you. Psalm 24:1, the earth is the Lord's and all it contains, the world and those who dwell in it. Haggai chapter 2, verse 8, this is not a book that we usually refer to, but has a point. The silver is mine and the gold is mine, declares the Lord of hosts. Deuteronomy 8:18, but you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who is giving you power to make wealth, that he may confirm his covenant which he swore to your fathers as it is this day. When God was speaking to the nation of Israel, he was reminding them, you know what? I am the one who gives you the power to make wealth. You were a people of absolutely no significance. I am the one that is enabling you to be able to do all these things. That principle still rings true with us. Who do you think gives you the ability and power to accomplish anything? But do you really understand that God owns everything? That nothing we have is inherently ours? Now, that's kind of a humbling thought. Because most of us want to say something like, well, but I worked hard for this. I mean, I went to school to attain credentials for this. I mean, if I work hard, doesn't it belong to me? Well, in the end, everyone will find out that you have nothing. When you die, you leave everything behind. There's nothing that you actually get to keep. But as a Christian, if we remember that everything belongs to God, what he's called us to do is to be the manager. Now, some of us don't understand managing. Managing is not for your sake. It's for something greater. And that's God's kingdom purposes. Second point, my heart always goes where I put God's money. My heart always goes where I put God's money. Now, you know, I remember the past hearing messages on money and so forth, and, you know, people will say something like, well, check out your bank account, and your bank account will show where your heart is. You know, so for some people, Amazon might be on there a lot. You know, Amazon's really convenient, I have to tell you. If you don't know where to look, just look on Amazon, because you can find almost anything on Amazon. So is my heart filled with Amazon? Or wherever else it might be? But the point is this, it's God's money. Where are you putting it? Does it represent God's interest? You know, that's why when you see the parable of the talents, and when Jesus talks about how the owner would give a talent to this servant, and, you know, 3 talents to this one and 5 talents to this one, it was not their money, it was his money. And when he came back to hold them accountable, he asked, what did you do with my money? We ask the same question. What are you doing with God's money? Well, what you do with your money does show where your heart is, like Matthew 6:19 talks about. Because your heart will always go and, in a sense, reflect where you put God's money. But you're going to have to give account for that. Third principle, heaven, not earth, is my home. Heaven, not earth, is my home. Turn to Philippians chapter 3. Verse 20 says, for our citizenship is in heaven, from which also we eagerly wait for a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who will transform the body of our humble state into conformity with the body of his glory by the exertion of the power that he has even to subject all things to himself. Now, one of the interesting things that's going on today is this whole issue of race and ethnicity and so forth. Okay? I don't know how many of you follow that kind of stuff. But it's getting more and more complicated. Because at the end of the day, you're going to ask, so where do you belong? Who are your people? Now, I don't know about you. I was born in South Central LA. Okay. I'm an American citizen. I speak English. And I don't believe I have a fobby accent. At least I don't think so. Not to knock any of you who do, okay? Sorry, I'm not sure how to get around that. You know, but there are some of you who are born in other countries. There are some of you who would identify according to some ethnicity. But the real question comes down to, do you really belong here as a Christian? Like, where's your greatest allegiance? If it's something to this world, it's going to pass. And in some ways, it's getting even more confusing. You know, like when we go to the Czech Republic, we say, we are Americans coming to teach English. So people look at us and go, are you sure? I go, I'm sure. I have a U.S. passport. I was born in South Central L.A., I only know English. Why are you questioning my identity? Because they're confused. They're not sure. But what's really sad is when, as a Christian, You're confused about where your home is. This world is not our home. Because this world is not our home. Our citizenship isn't here. It's almost like we're on a mission trip for our whole life. We're here for God's purposes. One day, we go home. And that's heaven. But do we really live as if that's true? You know, I think that's one of the things as I get older, it causes me to think more and more. So, what's really worth living for? Because after a while, as you get older, there are less and less things you're able to enjoy. You know, one of the sad things is even food. Like, if you don't take care of your teeth and your teeth get all bad and you can't really chew, you can't chew meat very well. And, you know, we joke about how at some point in life, it's like you revert back to a baby. It's like you start with baby food, you end with baby food. Everything's going to get blended, right? And then you go back to diapers. It's just like you come full circle. And you go, how sad. Like, that's what I have to look forward to. You know, there's a seminary Facebook site where you can exchange things. And one of the things I was offered was adult diapers. And I actually looked at it. Because I was like, they're free. You know, anything free, I should be prepared. I really thought about that because, like, that's closer to my reality. So is that what I have to look forward to in living on this earth? You know, going to the convalescent homes, even going to the rehab center when my dad was there and seeing other people that were there, I couldn't help but have this feeling like, you know, the last thing these people are going to remember is being in this convalescent home, strapped to a hospital bed, eating bland food, and having nurses and, you know, all these other support staff, seeing them as a burden because they're a pain. That's what you get to look forward to. And it's a sad picture. But that's this world. You know, and I know that's hard telling maybe most of you because you're still young and you're like, dude, why do you got to depress us? But this is reality. But the perspective in terms of what's able to sustain you as a Christian is to be reminded, this world is not my home. So why am I investing so much of my time and energy into a place where everything associated, it's going to burn? This leads to the next point, which is I should live not for the dot, but for the line. Okay? If you can imagine, so there's a dot, and then there's a line extending from the dot. This dot represents my life on earth. It's very brief. It's very short, but eternity extends from that. And for the Christian, this line is life in heaven. So life on earth has a beginning and an end. It's very brief. But the line that extends from that goes on forever. Now, if you're not a Christian, and I think it was John MacArthur who said this, this world is your best life now. Because that's all you're going to get. It gets much worse after this. So this world is actually all you have to look forward to. Because hell is real. And you will suffer for eternity. But for the Christian, though life can be hard, it's still just a dot. It's brief. But we have something to look forward to. Heaven. To be with Christ for all eternity. So when you have that perspective, what do you do with your money and possessions? Well, the reality is this. We will have to part with our money one day, one way or another. The only question is, when will you part with it? It was the missionary Jim Elliot, and many of you know this quote. He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. If you apply that to the idea of money and possessions, that's so true. All the money and all the possessions you will ever attain in this world, you cannot keep. So Jim Elliot, and he wrote this in college. Okay, he wrote this in college. So collegians, you are not exempt from using your brain to process God's truth. He said, you're not a fool if you give up what you cannot keep, so that you can gain what you cannot lose. Now, I think for some of us, we're not convinced yet that we're going to lose everything. Turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 5. And let's start at verse 10. And this is Solomon. Remember Solomon? He looks back at his life, and in reflecting, he realizes that there's so many ways that he was foolish, which is ironic because he's supposed to be what? The wisest man who ever lived, right? He asked for the greatest thing that someone could ask for of God, and that was wisdom. So here are his conclusions in the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 5, starting from verse 10. He says this, he who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. This too is vanity. When good things increase, those who consume them increase. So what is the advantage to their owners except to look on? Isn't that an interesting picture? If you have more good things, there are more people to consume them. So you can have this sort of attitude. Say you throw a food party at your home, okay, and you go all out. You get steak and sushi and whatever. But after all, you're watching everybody eating it. And you think, you know, I worked really hard, and they're just eating my food. And the more food I provide, the more they're going to eat. And the more people that will want to eat what I make. So Solomon says, so what's the advantage to these owners except just to watch it happen? Go on. Verse 12, the sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep. Why? Because he's got to worry about all his wealth. Right? And you hear stories about this. You know, all these people who invest in like the stock market, you know, they go public, you know, and they're wondering, you know, is their company going to grow or is it going to bust? And things are so volatile, and you know, for those of you who follow stuff like that, you know. Verse 13, there is a grievous evil which I've seen under the sun, riches being hoarded by their owner to his hurt. Now, here is what's really just tragic, is that someone who does make a lot, they're like, it's all mine, and I don't want anyone else to take advantage of it, so they just keep it for themselves. But what good is all that for themselves? All it does is reveal the greed in their heart. They are like Smaug, the dragon, who is satisfied to just sleep on all this wealth. And what good does it do? It doesn't even make for a nice bed. It's not comfortable, but it's because your heart is so encompassed with that greed. It's to your own hurt. Verse 14. When those riches were lost through a bad investment and he had fathered a son, then there was nothing to support him. I mean, talk about, you know, watching this happen throughout history. How many people have made bad investments and because of that, the consequence impacted their ability to care for their family. Verse 15 sums it up. As he had come naked from his mother's womb, so will he return as he came. He will take nothing from the fruit of his labor that he can carry in his hand. I don't think we take time to think about this enough. Maybe except when you go to a funeral. And when you go to a funeral, you look at that person who's lying in that casket and you realize there's nothing they could do with whatever is put in, even in that casket. You know, I remember thinking about this because there's a little box you can put in the casket and you can put little things in there. And I thought, but what's the point of putting anything in there? Who's going to look at it? I mean, the thought went through my mind, well, maybe if the rapture comes and, you know, I go up to heaven, and then after 7 years we come back, and maybe if, you know, California still exists then, maybe this plot will still be there, and maybe the coffin will still be there. I can go and check out the pictures that we put in there. I mean, I don't know. But I was thinking, why am I even thinking like that? Like, what's the point? I remember thinking, what would my dad want in the casket? I'm like, I don't know. Because there's no point to it. So you know what I put in there? I put some pictures of the family, and I put a UCLA pin. I was like, well, I know he loved UCLA, so I'm going to stick a UCLA pin in there. But in the end, it means nothing. This whole idea of not living for the dot, our life is so brief. You know, Angela and I were celebrating our 29th wedding anniversary today. And I'm thinking, wow, 29 years just went by. You know, and I, you know, since I officiated a lot of weddings, I see that when people say they're celebrating, you know, their first anniversary, their fifth anniversary, their 10th wedding anniversary, so forth. So when I see all that, I'm like, oh yeah, I remember officiating their wedding. And now it's like, I'm seeing their babies, like, you know, the babies are coming, and it's crazy. But life is just going. It just doesn't stop. And one day it will end. But if all you have to live for is the dot, you still have to deal with the question of eternity. What have you invested in for eternity? Solomon, if you remember, starts off the whole book of Ecclesiastes saying what? Life is vanity of vanities. It's empty. It's like chasing after the wind. You know, I remember speaking to a youth group on that one time, and I actually tried running around to show them what it meant to, like, run after the wind, and I fell off the stage. I didn't realize there was a drop, and but it was such a living illustration, you know. It was like, as you're running around crazy, you just fall off and you could die. I'm glad I didn't break anything, but I thought, how lame, but how true. I just lived out what he was talking about. Fifth, giving is the only antidote to materialism. Now, Randy Alcorn shares some interesting thoughts. He talks about this whole concept of the tithe, and if you remember in the Old Testament, the Israelites were called to tithe a certain percent. And we live in a New Testament era where, I mean, there are some churches that promote the idea of a tithe. We don't. We call it free will giving or grace giving. But what's really interesting, and I think Randy Alcorn made a really good point on this, for us to transfer the idea of saying, well, I'm not bound by a tithe, but I'm committing to this idea of free will giving. Well, then the question is, how freely are you giving? And he was saying that for the most part, most people don't give anything close to the tithe, which is anywhere from 10 to, you know, more percent, according to various Old Testament standards. But if anything, giving is reduced percentage-wise, and a commitment to materialism is expanded. Why? Because think about it. When you graduate from college and all your money was going into paying off your tuition and so forth, and then maybe you had to go to grad school, so you still have to deal with all this. It's almost like you're like, well, you know, I work so hard, I deserve something for myself. But think about, like, where's the ceiling on that? You know, you don't have to raise your hands on this, but we all like shopping of some sorts. It just depends what you like. Okay. So some people like to shop for clothes. Some people like to shop for toys. Some people like to shop for cars. Some people like to shop for islands. You know, I think it was Cristiano Ronaldo. He bought an island as a wedding gift for his agent. When his agent got married, like, who buys an island? I mean, what a gift. That's crazy, right? Yeah, I got you a small gift. It's a small island. Well, for all these people who have all this money, you can't help but feel like there is this inexorable pull towards materialism. It's almost like a moth drawn to the flames. The more you have, the more you're drawn to materialism. How do you stem that? Well, Randy Alcorn says the only antidote to that is giving. To be able to say, you know what, this money doesn't belong to me, so I'm not going to make it about me, because if I make it about me, I am prone to materialism. Just the constant pursuit of wanting things for myself. In 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and 9, and I want to direct you to the message that Amos Yang gave about a month ago, and it was a really challenging message. I would really encourage you to listen to it if you haven't. And he walks through just the whole idea of what it means to give. And if you consider those who gave out of their poverty, not out of their surplus. And the idea was not because you have leftover that you give, it's that you give of the first fruits. I mean, that was an Old Testament principle too. When they would harvest something, you didn't say, well, let me take care of all my bills and then whatever's left over, I'll give to God. It was, let me give to God first and I'll work within the rest to manage for the sake of his purposes. Giving is the only way to stem that sense of always wanting to promote what you want. You know, that's why for some of you, the challenge to give starts with going back to the beginning. First, I'm not going to take anything with me, but I can send it on ahead. It's God's. I'm just a manager of it. And if God calls me to then operate according to certain standards, am I doing that? The sixth point, God prospers me not to raise my standard of living, but to raise my standard of giving. Now, I think, you know, for anyone who comes to church, especially today, and you're listening to this message, and you're thinking like, you see, this is what's wrong with pastors these days. They always want to talk about you got to give more money to the church. Well, I want to challenge you to not just jump there, but what does God's word have to say about these things? Turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 9, starting from verse 10. 2 Corinthians 9:10 says this, "Now he who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness. You will be enriched in everything for all liberality, which through us is producing thanksgiving to God. For the ministry of this service is not only fully supplying the needs of the saints, but it is also overflowing through many thanksgivings to God. Because of the proof given by this ministry, they will glorify God for your obedience to your confession of the gospel of Christ and for the liberality of your contribution to them and to all." Now, when Paul was talking about this, he was talking about, you know, giving as an issue of obedience to God. Not as a means to fund just a program. And you're not here just to pay my salary. You know, I remember at a church I was at before, back in Maryland, one of the guys actually came up and said to me, "We are the CEOs, you are the employee. We pay your salary, so you do what we tell you to do." And I was like, I didn't know that. Can you show me? Can you show me in the Bible where you're the CEOs and I'm the one employee? How does that work when there's like 100 CEOs? I mean, are you even on the same page for the agenda? I don't know how that works. I was like, no, that's not how it works. I'm not your employee. Actually, Jesus is the CEO and he already has the plan for us to submit to. And I'm just one of those guys too. It was really sad that they would associate their giving with somehow saying we can control the pastor. Now, granted, there are pastors who want to manipulate churches to fund their own purposes, like that guy we talked about last week, right? He wants to get his fourth jet. Okay, that's ridiculous. If I ever ask you for a jet, just cut off my head. Okay, just put me out of misery then, okay? Not helpful. But let's say God prospers you. And I hope God does prosper at least some of you. But that prospering is not just for the sake of raising your standard of living, but it is to raise your standard of giving. I would really encourage you to read this book, because one of the things that he shares is that he challenges people to raise their giving. And he challenged one business owner to give $50,000 a year. And the guy goes, that's more than I even make. But he's like, well, maybe I should pray about it. And this guy owned a business, and what happened is God increased his business. He prospered him. And so the test was he going to actually then come through? And he did. And then the next year, he set as his goal to give $100,000. I'm just using this as an example, okay? You can read from the book. God prospered his business so that he could then attain that giving goal. And I was thinking, you know, I never heard that. You don't hear that kind of thing. You don't hear about people praying that God would prosper them so that they could give more. People, when they're prospering, tend to give less. But what it does is it shows where their heart is. And I think that last verse, 2 Corinthians 9:13, says this, because of the proof given by this ministry, they will glorify God for your obedience to your confession of the gospel of Christ. What ministry? This ministry of the service of supplying the needs of the saints. So the churches that Paul had planted and was going back to visit, they were all contributing to care for the needs of the believers in Jerusalem, because there were a lot of them. They're poor. But people were giving so that they would accomplish this ministry. But Paul describes it as, you are glorifying God by your obedience to your confession of the gospel of Christ. This is a reflection of your obedience to God in light of the gospel. And then he says, and for the liberality of your contribution to them and to all. Now, why are we going through all this? Well, as I shared, I think as a church family, because we're young, and many of us maybe have not heard messages on this, maybe you just have your own ideas, or maybe you have impressions that you might have received from somewhere else, or sometimes there's a lot of negative thought toward this because you hear of bad examples. Well, this is why at the beginning, you know, I really wanted you to understand, if God's truth carries this authoritative weight, what am I doing in light of his truth? Not just because there's something that's going to benefit Lighthouse Bible Church. That's not the point. Some of you will move on to other churches, maybe. That's fine. This still applies. It's what are you going to do in response to the truth? Not just what you do for a church. This really has to flow out of your understanding of what God calls for you to live in light of. That is, we are stewards. We are entrusted. Everything belongs to him. I mean, in the coming weeks, we're going to talk about what do we do with our time. Our time is not our own. Our talents, our gifts, they were not meant for self-promotion. Even our relationships, every single relationship, and even this church, is a stewardship for you to use for God's glory, to invest for eternity. So sometimes when you think, this is not easy. Yes, it's not easy. But this is why we look to the Holy Spirit to be the one who gives us the right heart attitudes, the right mindset to how we think, so that we would take God's truth and let it drive us toward obedience, so that we would honor him. This is not going to be accomplished by inducing guilt. You know, that's the Asian way. Make you feel all guilty. Tell you all the problems we have and make you feel bad. You're like, okay, I guess I'll give. No, that only lasts for a moment. Don't live for the dot. Live for the line. And that line is an eternal line. Am I investing for the sake of his kingdom? Well, let's bow our heads, and as we close, our time and prepare for communion. Please take some time to reflect on this. If you are not a Christian here this morning, I want to encourage you to consider what you're living for. Are you living for this world, which will pass away? You can invest all your energy, all your time, all your resources, and like that fool who said that he would build bigger barns so that he could enjoy and be satisfied for years to come, only for God to say, tonight, your life is going to end. Your soul is required. What will you have lived for? You will have only lived for that which is passing. And in settling for the dot, you concede an eternity. To suffer the consequences of rejecting God's grace and mercy offered to you through Christ. So it is our prayer as a church that if there's anyone here that does not know Christ, that you would turn away from placing your faith and hope in this world. That you would see the gravity of your sinfulness and that you would look to Jesus Christ to save you. For those of us who are Christians, maybe this morning is the time for us to reflect. And like I said, there are plenty of Christians who seem to follow the worldly route just like many others. You were bought with a price. You are not your own. You belong to Jesus Christ. Your life is called to be one that follows him in every respect. So how are you being a steward of the life that he has given to you? Are you seeking first his kingdom and his righteousness? Are you seeing your money, your possessions, and all that you've been given as a stewardship for the sake of serving his kingdom? Be reminded that Christ bought you with a price. You are no longer your own.